Today we'll hear the last in a series of conversations with speakers from the Kivira Coalition Conference. The conference was held in Albuquerque in mid-November. The Kivira Coalition brings together farmers and ranchers and environmentalists. You can find out more about them at kiviracoalition.org. I'd like now to welcome Renata Brillinger. She's Executive Director of the California Climate and Agriculture Network. Welcome to the Radio Cafe.
Thanks. It's good to be here.
So the California Climate and Agriculture Network, also known as CalCAN, what is it?
We are a coalition of five organizations in California that came together almost 5 years ago now to try to provide a constructive voice, the voice of sustainable and organic agriculture in California's state climate policy discussions and dialogues that have been going on there in the state for a while. We really see the climate crisis as a significant threat to agriculture. California agriculture is quite vulnerable to the impacts of climate change, not just California agriculture, but all farmers and ranchers are vulnerable to the changes that are already being felt and are going to worsen. And we think, and there's good science that shows, that there are also some solutions for the climate crisis that agriculture can provide. So, but there wasn't anybody in California bringing that perspective forward. So we're trying to do that, and trying to do it with the involvement of farmers and ranchers on the ground who give us a lot of advice and are pretty active in our work, as well as other stakeholders in the food and environment sort of arenas. So we've been focused on three different primary buckets, campaign efforts that all will help agriculture be more resilient and provide some climate benefits for the state.
Now, California has vast agricultural production. How much of that is like big ag, and how much of it is more like sustainable farming, organic farming, and things like that?
It's pretty hard to put numbers to that because, really your definitions are important. And so we think of sustainability as a continuum that a lot of growers sort of move along. Hopefully they're all moving. Hopefully we're all becoming more sustainable in all of our human endeavors. So, there are different measures, you could say, of sustainability. California is the birthplace of organic agriculture. That's one clearly defined type of sustainable ag practices. And it's a growing industry. There's a couple thousand California farmers that are growing organically that are certified. But there are many other measures. There are lots of other different kinds of certification programs that reward growers for being fish friendly, or the wine industry has its own whole sustainability stewardship program that they sort of self-administer. There's some federal funding for sustainability practices that's allocated through the Farm Bill process, and that's widely used throughout California. So I don't think anybody could put a specific breakdown.
Yeah.
But I think California is a $43 billion agricultural industry.
Wow.
It's a massive, massive, massive industry. And there's 400 crops growing there. So more than half of the country's fruits, nuts, and vegetables are grown in California. California is the leading dairy producer. It's a substantive industry, and it's quite varied within it. There's a great amount of consolidation. There are a lot of farmers who don't own their land that they grow on. They lease it. Almost half of California's farmers don't own the land they farm.
Interesting.
So that limits their stewardship opportunities in some ways, and it limits their investments in that given piece of land that they may only have for 3 years or whatever the lease terms are. So it's a complex, all that is to say, it's a complex agricultural environment, and really hard to break down by big ag versus sustainable ag.
Right. So what are some of the problems that you are facing in your organization, or that you're addressing, problems facing agriculture, and also some of the problems that agriculture causes?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's a complex set of interrelated challenges. Consolidation is a problem, and land ownership, access to land, is a problem.
What's consolidation?
The loss of small and medium-sized farmers and increasing ownership by fewer and fewer agricultural businesses. I think that's a problem in terms of the overall health of the system. I think if we start narrowing and narrowing and narrowing the means of production, or the owners of the food we produce, then we are going to end up with an increasingly industrialized approach to farming. I think one of the things that makes farmers such good stewards of the land is when they're on the land.
It's like the media. I mean, when you talk about that, it's like media consolidation. You used to have hundreds and hundreds of independently owned newspapers, and now you have like six media companies that own almost everything.
Bookstores, you know, coffee shops. I mean, it's kind of a problem in almost every business you look at. And I would argue that it, you know, that lack of diversity is bad for the marketplace. In fact, we've got, you know, antitrust laws to protect us against that at its extreme. In a food system that we want to produce food in the most ecologically healthful way, I think it's imperative that we have farmers as close to the land as we can, because that's what keeps people in touch with the impacts of their actions. So consolidation's a big, and land ownership's a big problem, or a big threat to the long-term sustainability of agriculture. Greenhouse gas emissions from agriculture are not negligible in California. They're about 7% of the overall state emissions totals. Transportation is by far the largest sector that is causing the greenhouse gas problem. But agriculture,
meaning getting the food to market?
Transportation of everything, the whole transportation system.
Yeah.
Us all driving our cars and getting food to market is part of that. But transporting goods of all kinds. That's the big elephant. But agriculture contributes 7% of the state's total just on the farm. You know, that doesn't count the emissions from transportation, packaging, or processing. It's just what can be measured on farms. So if you took the whole food system, that starts to be a pretty big chunk.
Yeah.
You know, if you really, but that's not how they break it out. So I don't have that number at my fingertips. So far, agriculture isn't regulated in California for its greenhouse gas emissions, but we are looking for ways to bring those emissions down, voluntary ways. California's got a big problem with nitrate contamination in groundwater. That's the direct result of runoff from synthetic nitrogen-based fertilizers and manure fertilizers that are spread, you know, from the dairies. We have a huge dairy industry, confined animal feeding operations that have this massive waste problem. So they spread manure on fields, and then that gets into finds its way into the groundwater. And that's creating a big public health problem for the communities in the big agricultural belt in the Central Valley. They don't have access to safe drinking water.
Yeah. We're talking to Renata Brillinger of the California Climate and Agriculture Network. Now, California has passed one of the most progressive pieces of climate change legislation in the country. It's called AB 32. What does it do, and what are its implications for agriculture?
AB 32 is a really complex set of programs that the state has been implementing since the bill was passed. It was passed 8 years ago. Everything from putting in place some energy efficiency rules about, you know, governing construction, to low carbon fuel standards for the cars that we drive there. The fuel has to be produced at a, you know, with a certain maximum level of carbon energy embedded in it, so that our transportation emissions are reduced that way. Mileage standards have come out of California. There are some clean energy programs that have come out of that package of programs that AB 32 requires. The goal of that package of programs is to get our greenhouse gas emissions in the state down to 1990 levels by the year 2020. That's the overarching objective. And then the bill lays out a number of ways to get there. The piece of AB 32 that's most relevant to our work and to agriculture is the cap and trade program that's supposed to achieve 19% or so of the emissions reductions over time. So in terms of implications for agriculture hasn't been directly regulated. The state hasn't said to the agricultural sector or to individual farmers, you need to reduce your emissions by X percent or anything like that. They have said that to some other sectors. They've said that to the utilities sector. So our electricity needs to be getting greener and greener, cleaner and cleaner over time. And there are programs in place to do that. The industrial sector has been regulated. So stationary sources of greenhouse gas emissions, big energy users, oil refineries, cement and fertilizer manufacturers, some big institutions like universities, food processing facilities, the big ones, they've all been capped. They've all been told this is your maximum limit and you can't exceed that without incurring fines.
But they didn't do that with agriculture.
Right.
I wonder why. I mean, it may be just like, it seems like a clean and natural industry?
It's more political than that.
Oh, okay.
I think more political and more scientific. It was hard to pass that bill. And agriculture and business and oil in general opposed it. Conventional agriculture, that is. We weren't formed when the bill was passed, so we didn't take a position. But some of our members did support it, actually, because they've been around for 20, 30 years. So, you know, there were trade-offs made in getting that bill passed. And one of them was to not pick on agriculture. Another consideration, though, is that it's a very different proposition to regulate farms than it is to regulate, say, Chevron oil refinery. You can measure how much stuff is coming out of a stack. You know, we have equations that tell us if you burn this much fuel of this type, that emits this much carbon dioxide. Agriculture is wigglier.
Yeah.
In terms of monitoring and measuring. It's a biological system. It's complex. It's unpredictable. It's just hard to quantify and draw a direct correlation between cause and effect in agriculture or in any other living system. Forests weren't regulated either. Forestry practices weren't regulated. There are some ways in which agriculture has been affected, though, by other parts of AB 32 other than cap and trade. For example, there were some standards put in place for diesel engines. Ag is a big user of diesel engines. Whether it's pumping for irrigation or tractors or, you know, other generators on farm. So some of those have had to be, there are programs in place where they need to be phasing in cleaner and cleaner machines, more and more efficient diesel engines. Transportation, you know, some of the trucks that are used in the agriculture industry have had to be upgraded with support, government support over time. The cap and trade program, though, is the biggest place where agriculture is going to have both, is going to have some opportunities, really, if we have anything to say about it.
Like what?
Well, so first I should explain cap and trade. Cap and trade is a generic concept, and how it actually gets designed is what's really important to pay attention to. There are cap and trade programs in other parts of the world that are different than the one California is putting in place. I mean, essentially what cap and trade does is it says to the biggest greenhouse gas emitters, here's your cap and you've got to decrease it over time. That's about all that it really says. And then how you design how that happens is where the creativity comes in and where it can be tailored to each individual program. In California, the Air Resources Board is the entity that's putting the program in place. And what they decided to do was enable a carbon market, set up a carbon market. That's one piece of the program. So if I'm a big emitter of carbon and I have a cap, I can meet that cap either by making my operation more efficient, just improving my energy efficiency and investing some money in upgrading my systems. And or I can mix these tools. I can do several of these things if I want. Another way is that I can buy on the marketplace carbon credits. So it creates a market for buyers like Chevron or like whoever, you know, whoever is one of these big stationary sources of greenhouse gas emissions. It also creates a market for players that are not regulated but want to change their practices and then get paid to do stuff that reduces their greenhouse gas emissions, and then they can sell that too.
So that's the opportunity for
farms.
That's
the opportunity, possibly.
Yeah.
The jury's still out about that. In order to take advantage of that, there are protocols that have to be put in place. You know, we want to make sure, of course, that if Chevron is continuing to emit greenhouse gases and they're paying a farmer to decrease their emissions, that they really are decreasing them. Otherwise, we haven't solved our problem.
Right.
And it's difficult to do that. These protocols that are being drafted will basically be the playbook by which the state can determine whether farmers really are doing it and it really is a greenhouse gas reduction.
It's such an opportunity for corruption and lying.
Yeah, there's a very stringent requirement. We should all hope that it's stringent, you know, that there be good verification and that these be things that really are new, you know, that the farmer wasn't already doing, because otherwise we haven't done it, made any improvement.
Yeah.
It has to be things that they would not have done had they not been paid to do it. That's another tricky thing to prove.
Yeah.
You know,
is this in place yet? I mean, are people trading carbon credits
yeah,
yet?
Yeah, absolutely. There's a voluntary market where there's been some carbon trading, you know, just players that want to do the right thing. And so they buy and sell carbon credits. There's also in California, there's a mandatory market in place. It's just that agriculture so far hasn't participated because there hasn't been protocols approved that would enable their participation.
Okay.
And it's proving very difficult to write those protocols, it turns out. Because of some of the things I already said,
yeah.
Because it's hard to measure in agriculture, right. Because with the kind of precision that we should require from this kind of scheme, you know, it's expensive to go onto a farm and measure the emissions. They come from the soil, they come from the plants, they come from the animals. We're not going to attach a monitor to every cow's, you know, behind or every manure pile or every field. I mean, it's a really tricky verification challenge. So instead, we have to look to computer models, and those take some years to, you know, design and calibrate and verify. And even then, in the end, the transaction costs for farmers of participating in this, complying with these protocols, it's pretty, you know, I would think that a lot of farmers are not going to be interested because it's bureaucratically challenging. Maybe some of the very biggest will be interested, but for Calcan, we're less interested in incentivizing those big operations. We're interested in helping the small and medium-sized folks stay in business and do the right thing. So that's one piece of the carbon market that may or may not help farmers. The piece we're really, and this is finally, you know, getting to what I hope is the nugget where the promise really lies. What California also did, in addition to creating this carbon market, they decided that there should be a requirement for these regulated emitters to also buy some permits to keep polluting. They're called allowances. They should be required to buy them on an auction, a certain amount, 8% right now. They should have to purchase from the state, and that generates a revenue source for the state of California to invest back into some voluntary climate solutions, climate protection activities among players that aren't regulated. So, for example, right now there's about $400 million that has been accrued through these auctions, and it's sitting waiting to be invested. The legislature also passed a bill that described how the general categories it should be invested in, and it includes things like public transportation. It includes low-income housing retrofits to make homes more energy efficient. That's a win-win. You know, that gets us more, it reduces our energy use, and it helps low-income folks cut their energy bills. It includes things like protecting forests. It includes sustainable agriculture, the work we did in the state legislature to advocate for a placeholder for sustainable agriculture paid off. And so in this sketch, this skeleton of how this money should be spent is a category for sustainable agriculture.
We're talking to Renata Brillinger of the California Climate and Agriculture Network. It does sound, I mean, to the uninitiated, like, okay, this is giving industry various ways to just keep polluting. They can buy pollution permissions at auction. They can continue what they're doing and buy credits, which we hope are worth something and really make a difference, but it's not actually getting them to change their practices if they've got the money to basically buy off, you know, to use the system mm-hmm. the way the system is set up.
You're pointing out something key that I forgot to mention, which is that cap that they all have placed on them starting last year declines by 3% a year.
Mm-hmm.
So it ratchets
down. So there's
down.
Your incentive.
That's not an incentive so much as a requirement.
Yeah.
That's a regulation. Yeah. So that was calculated, that decline, that slope was calculated to get those 350 factories and refineries to a level which would meet that target in the time we've got remaining.
So all the auctions and carbon credits in the world don't matter. They still have to.
They have these tools that they use at their discretion to figure out how to meet that cap. And the auction is one of those tools. The carbon market is a tool. And they, of course, can always go ahead and just retrofit their buildings or use cleaner fuel or install solar panels or whatever they choose to do. And the beauty of that, or the theory around that, is that that gives the industrial sector flexibility about making their own decisions about how they want to meet that cap, and hopefully minimizes the economic shock of them just having to step right up and retrofit their, you know, which can be very expensive.
Now, do we have yet enough data to know how it's working?
No.
Because I was going to say this, it could be an inspiration to other states
around the world.
But we don't even know if it works.
Not yet. It's only a year old.
Oh,
and in fact, the first year was a sort of a warming up year.
Yeah.
It was a voluntary compliance year.
No pun intended.
Yeah. Yeah. No pun intended. This year we're going into right now, starting basically now, is their first year of mandatory compliance. So it's all bets are off. It's the real thing now. We practiced for a year. Now we're, you know, you really do have to meet your caps. And they're 3% lower than they were last year. And you're right. This is a model that is being looked to widely. And there's a lot of wait and see going on, which is unfortunate in some ways. It'd be nice if there were some other risk takers, because California has been quite isolated on this and quite attacked by, you know, challenged from many directions. There's a lot of pressure. I think there are a number of other states that are going to jump in pretty quickly after a few years. I don't know what kind of trial period is going to be considered for making a decision to step ahead. But, you know, Washington State, Oregon, British Columbia, and California just signed a pact that they would work together on you know, reducing their emissions and coming up with creative climate solutions. So that could set the stage for some forward movement. I know New Mexico and Colorado at one point had been part of conversations. In fact,
I know.
Came close to signing it, you know, being part of a Western climate initiative.
Right.
Got cold feet, and we'll see, though. I mean, the best possible scenario would be that in, say, 2, 3, 4 years, California's program's been humming along, the economy's doing better than it ever was. This would be what I would hope. And we've been meeting our goals. You know, we've been ratcheting down the emissions. And perhaps there might be some other benefits starting to, you know, accrue. Things like if we have our way, we would see some money flowing to sustainable ag practices that would not only reduce greenhouse gas emissions, but possibly also have some water and air quality benefits. The nitrate contamination problem I mentioned earlier,
Right. The
same source of that is a huge contributor to climate change, to greenhouse gas emissions. Nitrous oxide also comes from nitrogen fertilizer. Some of it runs off and contaminates the groundwater, and some of it goes up into the atmosphere as a greenhouse gas. So if we can reduce the amount of nitrogen fertilizer we use by incentivizing farmers, paying them, supporting them in a transition away from those fertilizers to cover crops, to compost addition, to manure use, to a crop rotations, all of these things, there's good science showing that these can reduce greenhouse gas emissions overall. We may also be able to solve some of that nitrate contamination.
So let's get you back on the air every couple of years.
Get an update. Great. Yeah, that would be really good. Yeah. Because California is not going to solve the problem. This is a global problem. We all understand that. But it is a huge economy. It's a huge agricultural economy. And if it rolls out successfully, hopefully it will be a model and will be replicated. And then we'll really start to see some shifting going on.
Renata Brillinger is Executive Director of the California Climate and Agriculture Network. They can be found at calclimateag.org. Thank you so much for being with us on the Radio Cafe.
Thanks for having me.